Here around 11 degrees. Looking on to Sunday, it's a similar story. Much of England and Wales, another dry, warm, fairly sunny day. Could hit 20 degrees somewhere in the southeast. But again, northeast England, eastern Scotland, plagued by that misty low cloud coming in off the North Sea. And again, I think for Northern Ireland, perhaps some drier, brighter spells coming in after that rain begins to clear away. But yeah, certainly turning milder for most of us, I think, through the weekend and into the early part of next week. Now back to Jim Lee.
Thank you very much, Pete. And now the final episode of our Book of the Week, A Spy Among Friends. MI6 has finally uncovered proof that Kim Philby is spying for the KGB and sent his best friend, Nicholas Elliott, to confront him in Beirut. The reader is Simon Russell Beale.
Listen, Kim. You know I was on your side all the time from the moment there were suspicions about you. But now there is new information. They've shown it to me. And now even I am convinced, absolutely convinced, that you worked for the Soviet intelligence services. You worked for them right up until 49.
When Kim Philby said he was not surprised to find Nick Elliott waiting for him in Beirut, it was interpreted in MI5 as evidence that he'd been tipped off in advance. It sparked a hunt for another Soviet spy within British intelligence that lasted two decades, and a conspiracy theory that still smoulders today. In reality, Philby was stating a fact. He had feared exposure for years, and he knew that if the truth about his spying finally emerged, then Elliot would want to confront him with it. The two men met in a small apartment. In the bedroom, Peter Lum, the new MI6 station chief in Beirut, and a stenographer, both wearing headphones, were hunched over a turning tape recorder. The full transcript of the ensuing dialogue has never been released by MI5. Indeed, parts of the recording are almost inaudible. Elliot was no technical expert. Shortly before Philby's arrival, he'd opened the apartment windows, and as a result, much of their dialogue is obscured by noise from the street below.
You come here to interrogate me, and I keep thinking I'm talking to a friend.
Friend? You took me in for years. Now I'll get the truth out of you, even if I have to drag it out of you. You had to choose between Marxism and your family, and you chose Marxism. I once looked up to you, Kim. My God, how I despise you now. I hope you've enough decency left to understand why.
He laid out the deal. If Philby confessed everything, back in London or, if he preferred, in Beirut, then he would not be prosecuted. But he would need to reveal all. Every contact with Soviet intelligence, every other mole in Britain, every secret he had passed to Moscow over a lifetime of spying. Philby said nothing, and Elliot's voice hardened. If Kim persisted in denying the truth, he would be left in the cold. His passport would be withdrawn. He would not even be able to open a bank account. He would live the rest of his life as a penniless pariah. There was, of course, a third option. So obvious to both men that Elliot had no need to mention it. The double agent could cut and run. Philby was now on his feet and making for the door. The tea party was over.
You've been a lucky chap so far, Kim. You have exactly 24 hours. Be back here at precisely 4 p.m. tomorrow. If you're as intelligent as I think you are, you'll accept.
That evening, Elliot dashed off a reassuring telegram to Dick White, the head of MI6 in London.
Kim's broken. Everything's okay.
Inside, however, Elliot was deeply anxious. Would Philby cooperate, clam up, or try to escape? Next day, the 13th of January 1963, on the stroke of 4, Philby reappeared at the apartment. He seemed sober and composed.
Okay. Here's the scoop. But first, you owe me a drink. I haven't had one since my birthday on New Year's Day.
Elliot poured two large brandies. Philby then launched into a prepared speech, a peculiar confection of truth, half-truth, and lies. From his pocket, he drew two sheets of paper on which he had typed a sanitized, incomplete account of his work for Moscow with few details and fewer names. It was, nonetheless, a signed confession, admissible in a court of law. Philby had acknowledged being a Soviet spy. He would never be able to row back from here. Elliot had the upper hand. Philby was tempted by Elliot's offer. But would MI6 honour the deal? If he said too much, would he end up hanging himself? Was Elliot his friend still, or his nemesis? For 2 hours the two men drank and duelled, until the sun was setting and the sound of the muezzin drifted over Beirut. Listening to the tape recording many months later, MI5 officer Peter Wright said,
"By the end, they sounded like two rather tipsy radio announcers, their warm, classical public school accents discussing the greatest treachery of the 20th century."
Elliot called the next morning and invited Philby and his wife Eleanor to dinner at one of Beirut's most fashionable restaurants. Kim was visibly anxious, and Elliot's behaviour was as odd. When Philby got up to go to the restaurant toilets, Elliot also excused himself and followed him. Over the urinals, Philby handed over a sheaf of typewritten pages, the second instalment of his confession, and much fuller than the first. Philby was producing the goods. The following day, Philby and Elliot met once more. This time, Elliot brought his own paperwork, a single sheet of paper on which was written a list of names, perhaps a dozen in all. Elliot passed it over. Which of these individuals were Soviet spies? Two of those named were Anthony Blunt and John Cairncross, the fourth and fifth men in the Cambridge network. The exchange threw Philby's predicament into sharp relief. Whether he returned to London or stayed in Beirut, he would effectively be a prisoner of MI6. The lifeline of immunity offered by Elliot was really a noose. The man who had been Philby's protector for so long would now be his jailer. The confrontation had lasted 4 days. Elliot told Philby that he would be leaving the next day. Peter Lunn, the MI6 station chief, would take over the debriefing process in Beirut. London would send more questions, and the Americans would want to talk to him. The process of interrogation was only just beginning. As Elliot prepared to hand over to Lunn, he reported that Philby was still unpredictable, in a nervous, drunken, and depressed state.
"He might, I suppose, commit suicide."
Elliot no longer cared if his former friend lived or died. That at least was the impression he gave. Kim Philby and Nicholas Elliot shook hands and parted with one last display of their old amity. Ostensibly, they were back on the same side and friends once more. But both knew this was untrue. Elliot's decision to fly to Africa, leaving Philby unguarded in Beirut, was later condemned as a critical mistake that enabled Philby to pull off one last espionage coup. But there is another, very different way to read Elliot's actions. The prospect of prosecuting Philby in Britain was anathema to the intelligence services. Another trial so soon after the George Blake fiasco would be politically damaging and profoundly embarrassing. Philby had already demonstrated his skill at handling the press. He knew far too much. Nobody wanted him in London, but keeping him in Beirut indefinitely was almost equally unpalatable. Once Philby was fully interrogated, what would be done with him? Burgess and McLean had both defected, allowing Philby to join his friends in Moscow. To do a fade, in intelligence jargon, might be the tidiest solution all round. Elliot could not have made it easier for Philby to flee, whether intentionally or otherwise. Philby was not followed or watched. His phone was not tapped. He was left to his own devices. That was either monumentally stupid or exceptionally clever. The very next evening, on the stroke of 6 o'clock, Philby stood on the balcony of his flat on Rue Cantari with a book in his hand, the signal that he needed an urgent meeting with his KGB case officer, Petukov. They met a few hours later in a back street restaurant. It took Philby only a few rushed minutes to explain the situation. MI6 had new and damning evidence and had offered him immunity in exchange for information. He did not tell his KGB handler that he had already confessed. Petukov hurried back to the Soviet embassy and sent a cable to Moscow Center. He was told that Philby should be extracted from Beirut as soon as possible. Petukov briefed Philby.
"Your time has come. They won't leave you alone now. You have to disappear. There's no other way. There's room for you in Moscow." If you see me carrying newspaper, that means I have to meet you. If I'm carrying book, that means everything is prepared for your departure and you have to get moving.
Philby waited. A few days later, on the 23rd of January 1963, Glenn Balfour Paul, the first secretary at the British Embassy, threw a dinner party. Several journalists were invited, including Mr. Harold Philby of The Observer. Philby had spent the morning drinking coffee on his balcony, despite the lashing rain. A figure carrying a book walked slowly past in the wet street without looking up. In the late afternoon, Philby grabbed his raincoat and scarf and announced he was going to meet a contact, but would be home by 6. He was seen at the bar of the St. George's Hotel. After downing several drinks, Philby asked the barman if he could use the telephone. He rang Eleanor to say he was going to be late and he would meet her at the embassy dinner at 8. But 8 o'clock came and went at the Balfour Pauls with no sign of Kim Philby. The storm outside was building and Eleanor was becoming worried. While she waited at the dinner party, a car with diplomatic plates was driving towards the harbour. In the back sat Philby. The car entered the port and pulled up alongside the Dolmatova, a Soviet freighter taking on cargo and bound for Odessa. The Russian captain shook hands with Philby on the gangplank and led him to a cabin. A bottle of cognac stood on the table. Philby, his minders, and the captain raised their glasses and drank. Petchukov handed him an identity card in the name of Vili Maris, a merchant seaman from Riga. New clothes were laid out on the bed, including warm underwear. It would be cold in Moscow. Eleanor left the dinner party before midnight and returned home through the rain. There was no sign of her husband and no message. She was now seriously alarmed. Soon after midnight, she telephoned Peter Lunn at home.
God, what a horrible night. Perhaps he's been hit by a car or stumbled into the sea.
Lunn asked if anything was missing, such as his clothes, but all was in place, including his British passport. Lunn surely knew that Philby was doing a fade and already on his way to Moscow. He immediately telephoned the British ambassador, then wrote a 26-paragraph cable to Dick White, head of MI6. Before dawn, a Russian freighter weighed anchor and headed out to sea. At the rail, wrapped up against the cold in his Westminster school scarf, Harold Philby watched the dawn break over the receding bay, knowing that his last link with England had been severed forever. To Nicholas Elliot fell the delicate and exceedingly unpleasant task of breaking the news to James Angleton at the CIA. Angleton was publicly incensed and privately mortified. Like Elliot, he now had to face the awful truth and acknowledge that his British friend had been a senior KGB agent. This American master spy had been taken in by a spy far more adept than he. The long liquid lunches, the secrets spilled so easily more than a decade earlier, the death and disappearance of so many agents sent to make secret war in the Soviet bloc. It had all been part of a brutal game, which Philby had won, hands down. Or had he? Among those who thought that Elliot and not Philby had won the last round was Kim Philby himself. He left Beirut thinking he had jumped. Only later did Philby come to believe that he had been pushed. Nicholas Elliot kept a part of Philby with him always. He treasured an old ebony-handled brolly he had bought so many years ago, in admiring imitation of his closest friend and his worst enemy. When Elliot died in 1994, he left behind a short memoir with a rueful, self-mocking title. Never judge a man by his umbrella. It was a joke that only two people could have fully appreciated. Nicholas Elliot and Kim Philby.
A Spy Among Friends was written by Ben McIntyre and read by Simon Russell Beale. Other parts were played by Gareth Armstrong, Sandra Duncan, David Timpson and Martin Wimbush. It was abridged by Barry Johnston and was a Heavy Entertainment production for BBC Radio 4. BBC Radio 4. Now, starting at midday today and continuing throughout the spring and summer, essential maintenance work will be taking place at the Droitwich Longwave transmitter. This will mean that some parts of the UK may not hear the midday shipping forecast via Longwave. However, you will be able to hear it live by going to the Radio 4 homepage, clicking on Listen Live and searching for Radio 4 Longwave. Now, this only affects the midday forecast. The other forecasts will continue to be broadcast in all the usual slots across Radio 4. Well, now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Saturday the 29th of March. There's a warning of gales in Biscay. The general synopsis at 1800, new low expected East Sole 1003 by 1800 Saturday. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking north at Zira. Easterly or northeasterly 3 or 4, occasionally 5 at first in Viking, then becoming very...